Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, did you tweet while you watched the Democratic debate? Did you catch the Lev Parnas interview on the Rachel Maddow show and share something about it on Facebook to inform your friends? After all, you're politically active. You're civically engaged. You listen to this show, after all. Eitan Hersh is the author of a new book, Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. In 2018, a year of midterm elections, Hersh, a political science professor at Tufts University, asked a random sample of 1,000 Americans how much time they spend on political activities. A third of them said they spend 2 hours or more each day on politics. 2 hours a day devoted to politics, to civic engagement. Wow. But wait. 4 out of 5 said that the time is not spent on any real work, organizing, volunteering, anything active. And of those 1 in 5 who said they were actually doing anything, the amount of time they devoted to political work was infinitesimal.
They read the newspaper, they listen to NPR, and then they could listen to a bunch of podcasts or watch MSNBC or Fox News for hours. And even if the stuff they're learning about is, you know, gossip and minutia, they'll say, it's my civic duty to be informed. But if you ask them, like, okay, well, who should I vote for in a local election? They would say, I have no idea. I don't know anything about the local elections. I don't know anything about this state. I really could just tell you a lot about Moisturegate, Sharpiegate, the Mueller investigation, but I can't tell you a thing that would actually inform your vote.
You found political hobbyism is a bigger problem for Democrats?
Well, it's a big problem for people who are college-educated news followers. And right now, those people are overwhelmingly Democratic. They think about politics as their civic duty, and they're in a social network where people talk about politics. But if you ask them, can you come to this community meeting where we're going to do something, they would say, I don't really have time for that. The status quo, as much as people might lament it, is pretty good for people like me, for college-educated white men. They don't feel particularly under threat. So they might say, Trump's awful, or Obama's awful, or polarization is awful. You don't see them out there doing anything about it.
A college grad isn't so special anymore as it was a generation or two back. We don't feel that the nation depends on us.
That's right. At the same time as the college degree population has skyrocketed, say, since the 1950s, civic engagement has declined rapidly. Since 1952, the American National Election Studies has asked every year how interested you are in the election. And 2016 was the peak. 2016 was the high point of interest. But when it came to saying you volunteered, you worked for a party organization, you worked for a campaign, 2016 was below the historical average.
You also suggest women spend less time on social media, but they spend more time actually doing political work.
Yeah, this is an amazing thing that you can see anytime if you go talk to a group on the left, say like an Indivisible group, or even on the right, like in church groups, the people there are almost all, are predominantly women.
Right at the start of your book, you described sitting on the couch, quote, a pile of laundry sits next to me. Over some 2 hours, I folded half-heartedly as I watch TV and clutch my phone. I refresh my Twitter feed to keep up with the latest political crisis, then toggle over to Facebook to read clickbait news stories, then over to YouTube to see a montage of juicy clips from the latest congressional hearing. I then complain to my family about all the things I don't like that I have seen. What I am doing, you say, isn't politics. It's political hobbyism.
Well, in this book, I follow about 7 organizers, and they are people who are trying to get power. They have community associations that are designed to win over people to their side. They're clearly doing politics. That is, they're trying to get power, and the way they're getting power is by essentially serving other people so that those other people who maybe don't care so much about politics will give them their votes. The rest of us, what we're doing is not trying to really get power. Maybe we don't want it so bad as we say we do. Maybe we don't know how. They know how to throw $5 donations at a candidate. They know how to vote in a presidential election. but they don't really think about, well, okay, what can I do locally that actually multiplies my own vote into more votes?
You start the book with an anecdote. It takes place in a Republican stronghold in Pennsylvania. A few lonely liberals rattling around a hall trying to organize.
Yeah, there's this woman, Angela Aldous, a nurse who started this group. And at first I see this room of about 50 people who they looked like they could be a variety of mostly retired liberals anywhere in the country. And in walks this guy who sits at my table who looks very different. He has this big, thick beard. And he introduces himself. This is a liberal organization in this Republican stronghold. And he tells everyone at this table that he's an evangelical Christian and he's pro-life and he's Republican. At first, you can see the people at this table squirming. And you have to understand the background is this organization is of people who knock on their doors of their neighbors. Sometimes they wear Kevlar vests. They're afraid to talk to their neighbors and try to convince them to vote mostly for Democrats. And so they see this guy, and it turns out that he was really upset about some of the behavior of the president, and he felt like his community of evangelical Christians in this town were going down a path that he thought was racist, and he wanted to see what this liberal organization was like.
And it's no accident, you write, that he showed up there. His appearance was the product of a tremendous amount of work on the ground.
And also an attitude by the leaders of this organization that this has got to be a slow and steady organization that's welcoming to a very diverse range of people, because you can't win in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, the way you can win in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so they welcome him. And sure enough, a few months later, I get text message from Angela, the lead organizer in this group, of her canvassing with this gentleman, getting people to vote for state and local offices for the Democratic Party. I totally changed my image of politics writing this book, because the way I thought about it as a political science professor and as a national news reader is, what difference can any person make? We're such a small drop in the bucket compared to the whole large country. But the organizers don't think about it that way. The organizers think, okay, I have my one vote. How many more do I have in me to get? In the book, we encounter this old man, Nakh Visoki, who's been called the Ukrainian boss, who over a couple decades influenced 1,000 votes. This precinct of retired refugees from the former USSR had 2 or 3 times the turnout every election than the precincts around it. That's one guy with 1,000 votes.
How'd he do that?
The same way all these people do it, which is by building rapport with their neighbors. This guy drove his neighbors to doctor's offices. He helped them study for their citizenship tests. In the end, he didn't have to persuade them that any one candidate was great. They just know that he's great. And that's why they give them their vote. And this is like such an important lesson. If you're not in an organization and you don't rely on other people, then if a candidate's not a star, it's not Barack Obama, it's not Donald Trump, it's not a celebrity, or maybe at a time where your party is down, like 2010 for the Democrats, you stay home because it's the party or the candidate that's inspiring you or not inspiring you. But when you're in a community of organizers, when you're in maybe a church community, then the reason you vote in any election is not because of who the celebrity on the ballot is. It's because your buddy who you trust says, hey, we got to go vote. You see right now on the right among evangelical Christians, say, some of whom really don't like Donald Trump, don't like his tweets, don't want him teaching their Sunday school kids. They say, hey, this guy is the vehicle for our values, so we got to do it. And they push each other forward.
So do you really believe that if people spent less time talking about politics, they would do more actual politicking?
It's a very hard question to answer. You know, I kind of put it to the reader of the book. I mean, do you actually want power for your side? Maybe you don't, and you're just happy kind of consuming all this information. And okay, just so you know, other people out there want power more than you do, obviously. And in the book, I talk about groups like the KKK who are out helping opioid addicts, saying, hey, your opioid addiction is not your fault, and we're here to help you. Come visit us.
Yeah, this was the KKK in North Carolina in 2018.
That's right. And so if you're comfortable with that, yeah, like I'm happy. I'm sitting on my couch. I'm pretty comfortable. And other people who want power will go out and do the dirty work. Then fine. But I think a lot of people feel sad about the state of political affairs and they don't know what they should be doing. And so I want to show them, hey, actually, there's something you can do. And it's getting power for your side, for your views, for your issues. And that requires you to change people's minds about whether they're going to vote and who they're going to vote for.
A fascinating part of your book was a description in the 1950s of what the political scientist James Q. Wilson called amateur Democrats, which were very much like today's hobbyists.
That's right. With one exception, they were involved in community meetings in their neighborhoods. Folks in professional jobs after the war, they really resisted the party machine. You know, in cities like New York, it was corrupt and it wasn't supportive of liberal values. And so this professional class formed what was a short-term movement of what was called Club Democrats. And they met in clubhouses and in living rooms and they had cocktails or coffee and they talked big ideas.
So they had a social scene, but not one that would prompt them to canvass, for instance.
That's right. It was hard to get them to see value in organizing a neighborhood, in, you know, helping a neighbor with their potholes. That's what the machines were really good at. The machines were bad in a lot of ways, but the machines were good when they were good at responding to people who maybe politics wasn't important to them, but they did care that someone was there fixing their potholes or fixing their streetlight. Or maybe there's examples in, say, Chicago's machine of Mayor Daley, cash assistance. The amateurs hated all that. They wanted politics to be about these big ideas. They cared about liberal values, civil rights, but they didn't want to dirty their hands in grassroots organizing.
Because it was a little dirty.
You know, power can corrupt, but if you really want something out of politics, you have to actually make this choice. Empower leaders in your community, and they might burn you. But they're also the only vehicle we have for power for good things.
And when you're talking about people who feel detached or sad about politics, all the indications are that cable news or too much social media or news consumption in general will deplete you, whereas actual engagement can invigorate you.
Right. In the same way that all community engagement, whether it's religious or civic, is correlated with being happier, this is too. I think if you kind of imagine an in-person version of politics based on what you experience on social media, it just seems awful. It's angry. It's antagonistic. How could a liberal convince a Fox News viewer to take their side or vice versa? But then you go to a community meeting like that one in rural Pennsylvania, or one anywhere in the country, and you see something much different, much more uplifting and positive, where they slow and steady move people in their direction. So I think it's just a much more positive experience than people imagine it to be.
Writing in The Cut recently, the day after the assassination of General Soleimani, writer Bridget Reed describe the sensation of watching the stream of reactions on Twitter. She wrote, "It was terrifying to be suddenly aware of how much time and attention I've given over to this strange place where everything happens, but nothing happens. Convincing me I'm doing something when I'm doing nothing, risking nothing. Or worse, there's nothing else I can actually do or risk, when of course there is."
I think politics seems so sad online often because we follow these news stories, and they're big news stories, at least at any time they seem big. The Mueller report seemed so big, and the Ukraine story and impeachment, these are big historical moments. But my role as a citizen in those moments is not important. I'm not important to what's happening in the impeachment or what's happening with the military in Iran. But I am important if I place myself in a community.
Eitan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Eitan Hirsch is a political science professor at Tufts and author of Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Coming up, two families that feud with most of the nation. This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.